You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome to the show today, Your Ultimate Life, the show that's dedicated to one thing, and that's to help you build the life you want, a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy. Really excited today to have a special guest, Philip Auerbach, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about him in a minute, but welcome to the show, Philip.
Thank you, Kellen. Delightful to be here.
I'm stoked to have you. So, Philip, I could say a bunch of things about you, but they'll come out in the interview, and I'd rather have it do it in conversation. So rather than read some kind of intro, which I'm not going to do, I'm going to ask an interesting question to start with.
Okay.
I know something of your heart and some of your mission in the world. And so without being modest, I'd like you to share with me, how is Philip intentionally adding good to the world?
Oh, wow. Well, in three primary ways, and I am modest, so I don't necessarily like to talk a lot about myself. But
well, I'm asking you to.
Yes, thank you. So for almost 35 years, I've had a company called Auerbach International, and we use languages to connect cultures and unlock business opportunities worldwide. And so effectively, we bridge communication gaps to ensure that communications are crystal clear and do so in a way that both acculturates, that does cultural adaptation as well. So again, we help companies or organizations, nonprofits, to expand into the world and bridge communication gaps. Another way I do that sort of in spare time is running an interfaith dialogue group, which I've had perhaps for 16 years or so. At times I've tried to resign, but the members won't let me. So it's a group that's really open to everyone, as long as everyone is respectful, both a respectful listener and learner. And it brings together Christians of all kinds, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, atheists, many people who have no religion, some religion, whatever, and just to really enable people to understand each other and to bridge gaps and to, again, not fall into traps of racism, for example. Mm-hmm. And the third way is that I had for quite a few years a nonprofit, and some California bureaucrat forced us to close down temporarily. And I then moved it to Pennsylvania, where I have not relaunched it yet. But it will be called the Nonprofit Uplift Foundation. And in essence, it is a nonprofit that provides resources, classes, unique funding opportunities, and will provide automatic grants for small and medium nonprofits to empower them to deliver their missions more effectively. So just in those three minor ways.
You know, each one of those could be an entire conversation. Let's start with the languages. One of the things that really stuck out for me about you was your own love of, affinity for, and ability with languages. So how many languages do you use? Do you speak or write, or, you know, that can you manage?
I've studied eight. I claim that I can speak French and Japanese quite well, but I don't speak the others well enough. Actually, if I try to speak Spanish, it comes out as a mixture of French and Italian, so I don't even bother. French is my second language, and Japanese is my third, and my Japanese is a bit not to the level that I would like, but when I go back to Japan, I'm sure that will improve.
What made you, languages would be a good reason, but what made you decide, like, you were quite articulate in explaining, you know, the acculturation and the benefits of translation and expanding business opportunities around the world. What happened that made you decide, like, you're the only person that I've ever had on shows, and I've done thousands of episodes, that runs a translation service, actually not quite, Almost. But runs a translation service specifically, and I love the way you described it, you know, the acculturation and helping business opportunities and stuff like that. What made you decide that's how you wanted to, like, make a mark?
Well, some of it arose in very, very early childhood, and then it evolved from there. So I'll tell you the story. I call myself a divorced child, and I know the proper term is child of divorce, but I prefer the term divorced child. And I'm actually, as far as I know, I'm one of the original ones. Now, divorce has been around, been in the world for, you know, thousands of years probably. But in this country, it was still very, extremely rare when I was a child and growing up. And my parents separated when I was 1.5. And divorced when I was officially divorced when I was 3. And my father and mother lived right near each other within, you know, 15, 20 minutes drive of each other. So I would be with my mother, of course, during the week and be with my father on weekends. And as a child, I could not, absolutely not figure out what was going on. My mother was very simply very. My mother and her family, and I'm speaking of my father and his family. My mother was very unconditional and loving and nurturing, and my father and his family were very conditional, strict, and rigid. And this, to me, did not compute. I could not figure out what was going on. So effectively, this was my first intercultural experience.
Wow.
Negotiate and navigate between two very, very different families whose value systems, whose assumptions, and whose expected behavior was very different. And the result was that I was incredibly lonely as a child because literally there was no one else to relate to communicate with, and to be understood by. And my father, to his detriment, did not consider that did not acknowledge that my feelings and my thoughts were valid. It was always critical, and you're imagining things, that's ridiculous, how can you think that, that's absurd, you know, on and on and on. And my mother, of course, and her family did acknowledge and did validate me. So I probably had this very irrational thought. Let me back up for a moment. So to his credit, my father was one of the pioneers of the computer industry. And he traveled a lot when I was a very young child. He traveled a lot, primarily to Europe, and brought me from his travels, brought me coins back from other countries and sent me postcards from other countries. So at a very young age, I was aware that there was a world out there, a world that was different than mine. And somehow I assumed that the world had to be better abroad than it was at home. And I then had this irrational thought that if I can't communicate with my father in English, if he can't understand me in English, perhaps he could understand me in another language. Now, that was totally irrational because he only spoke English, and I knew that. So again, it made absolutely no logical sense. When I was a little older and going into seventh grade, all of us students had to choose a language. And there are three languages offered, Latin, French, and Spanish. I knew nothing, whatever, nothing at all about languages. My mother had taken Latin when she was in school, and she told me that I would take Latin because I'm in the same school as she was, that she went to. All right, fine, what did I know? So Latin was my introduction to all of this, and it was the first year, it was an absolute struggle, a total, not a nightmare, not at all, but a total struggle, because to learn Latin, you have to learn English, or you have to learn your native language's grammars and structure and so forth, and in a very detailed way. And so it became a puzzle, a mystery to me. I'd never heard these concepts before: noun, verbs, direct object, indirect object, whatever the hell these things were. What was sort of fun was at the lunch tables in our junior high in those days, the kids who were learning French were speaking French with each other. The kids who were learning Spanish were speaking Spanish with each other. And we Latin kids did not speak Latin with each other. There were no Romans around to speak with. So I didn't quite know what to do. And I heard this, the kids speaking French, and I asked my mother also, in addition to learning Latin, could I also learn French? So she had a friend who was effectively a war bride, a French woman who had married an American soldier, spoke flawless English, and this woman gave me private lessons, French lessons, also in seventh grade, and I took to it extremely well, just absorbed it. And as an aside, I was the first student she had, and she assumed that all Americans would learn French as well as I did. She then became a professional French teacher at a private high school and was shocked to learn that
America, wildly disappointed, right?
Wildly disappointed how unskilled most North Americans are at learning French. But that was my introduction to other languages and the exposure to the world. And in the course of my, I started traveling abroad at a very young age. Both my high school took trips abroad during spring vacation. The Latin kids went to Italy. The French kids went to France. The Spanish kids, I think, went to Mexico, whatever. So that was my first introduction to my own world of travel, in addition to my father's background. And then again, I was aware of and learning other languages in this process. To make a long story short, in the process of learning languages, I was approached. Well, many years later, I had my own consultancy, and I was approached out of the blue one day by a group of translators, and they asked me, would my company and I be interested in marketing them? They were in a country that you will probably never guess, because it doesn't make any sense that they would be there, but they were certainly abroad. And this was far before the internet, far before major computer connections. One communicated in the world by fax and something called a telex machine.
Right.
And so at that point, this was, you know, much later in my career by that time, I had already acquired a master's degree in international marketing. I had studied perhaps six or seven languages. And when this group of translators approached me, I said, well, this would fit between the languages that I've learned and my international marketing degree, my master's in international marketing from a school called Thunderbird. Let's give it a go. And here we are almost 35 years later.
An amazing success story. So I want to dive into the benefits, like things that have happened. Fascinating story about how you got there. It's an evolution of your own developmental story, right? Like, yeah. So much of how what we do and how we feel and how we look at the world is part of that. So as you've done this, tell me, it doesn't have to be the most, but one or two of the most interesting business things that you've been able to facilitate through this translation that you do to increase marketing, to help people get something done they didn't think they could do, just that this facility and love for languages has provided to somebody's business.
Well, first of all, let me clarify, and this is an issue that most people are not aware of. Translating refers to converting anything written into another language, and interpreting is to convey anything spoken into another language.
Okay.
So interpreting, for example, is meetings and conferences and phone calls and so forth, and translation is anything written, documents, videos, websites, and so forth. So we've certainly had some very interesting projects over the years. One of the ones that I think is most impactful is that for many years, our company is based in California, and we have had for many years a contract with the California Department of Motor Vehicles to translate all of their learning manuals and all of their tests for immigrants into, I think it's something like 31 or 32 immigrant languages. So
wow.
I can say very proudly that if you are driving in California and you are not hit by an immigrant, that is partially because of us. So you're welcome.
All right. Yeah, thank you.
Another wonderful project we had was the world's only self-narrated life story of the Dalai Lama, which the producer asked us to translate and subtitle into 21 languages so that she could expand the movie abroad into incredible world markets, including, and one of the languages, amazingly, was Arabic. So Tibetan and Burmese and Chinese, one would understand, but, you know, European languages and Arabic were some of the others. So that was extremely exciting and wonderful and, you know, beneficial to the world. And we've just had many other, we do projects, for example, for public health organizations, both in San Francisco and California, and local health organizations. We do a lot of, again, you know, every project is useful to, obviously useful to its, to the client, whether it's an organization, a nonprofit, a private sector business, whatever. So if we're doing a manual, if we're translating a video, if we're translating a website, obviously it's impactful to the people who are the target audience of that client. So we've just got many stories I could tell you, some of which are very amusing, some of which are, you know, very useful. But they're all very, very different.
Maybe some of those will come up in a minute. One of the things I've been thinking about since we chatted a few weeks ago the first time was, you know, I've written a lot of books, and I've been thinking about, you know, not just translating, and I wasn't aware of the distinction, it makes sense, interpreting and translating, but translating them into other languages. My first thought from the U.S. would be Spanish because of the proximity of the South American countries. Uh-huh. But I have to then think also about all the peripheral and support materials. But you've got me really thinking about that in terms of business opportunity and expanding markets.
Right.
So I for one have been impacted by our conversation just about the ideas and, you know, the possibility of doing that, because we get myopic and think, I mean, I live in Canada, but still, you know, that we just sort of forget. Accidentally, it's kind of embarrassing, but forget about the rest of the world, which is kind of sad, don't you think?
Very much so. Well, look, you know, it's understandable because North Americans are surrounded by two enormous oceans on the east and the west, and Canada has the Arctic Ocean to the north. The United States has Canada to the north, which is always a wonderful, friendly country. Mexico to the south, of course. So one can live here in splendid isolation, not realizing that there's a world out there, but also most U.S. Americans are totally oblivious to the fact that 42 million U.S. Latinos speak Spanish at home. That makes us the second largest Spanish country in the world after Mexico. So between, you know, ethnic minority groups here, the Latinos and Arabs and Russians and Filipinos and so forth, that's a huge market by itself. And then, of course, the world market. And again, most people have no clue, no realization that 72% of the world does not speak English. So that's an enormous opportunity for people to expand into countries and cultures they never had dreamed about. And also 60% of world internet users will only buy your product or service if you present it in their native language. So again, that's an enormous market that most people don't even think about or not aware of. And so what we do is to help private sector enterprises, nonprofits, and governments of all kinds, federal, state, and local, target these audiences, whether they're in our home country or abroad or around the world, and to facilitate communication, to expand the benefits of products and services, and frankly, also to employ people. And this is something that that many companies forget, that the more they expand in the world, the more employment they are creating for themselves, but also people have to have money to buy their products and services abroad. When people buy their products and services, that in turn enhances the company itself, the company that is the organization that is doing this work. And so it's a wonderful virtuous circle.
I love it. Yeah, no, I love it. And, you know, we're about adding good to the world. And I didn't realize 60% of people won't buy it unless it's in their native language. Yeah. I'm repeating your statistic because it's true. And it's very, very attention grabbing. So we'll come back to languages in a minute, but maybe. Mm-hmm. But I want to go to one of the other two things that you talked about for a minute. I don't think you mentioned this when we chatted before. You said you've been running for a billion years or so, not quite, but a multi-faith sort of interdenominational thing to help people with communication and getting along and being nice to each other. And you said it much more eloquently than I do. And I'm just saying, hey, to be nice to each other. Yeah. So what made you, I mean, I understand the childhood disconnect about having totally different, two different houses every single week where things were all different. But what made you decide religion, which is one of the, you know, politics and religion, two most difficult things to talk about? What made you start that?
Well, just like my company, it started by total accident. My ex-wife and I were at a class at a synagogue where it was fascinating. It was a rabbi and an imam. An imam is a Muslim prayer leader, not necessarily holy, but the head of a mosque. A rabbi and an imam comparing and contrasting different passages from the Bible and the Quran. Mm-hmm. And it was really fascinating. It was open to everyone. So mostly Jews and Muslims were there, but I think there was a smattering of Christians as well. And at the end of the class, people wanted to continue. And for some reason, I was sitting near the rabbi or next to the rabbi quite often and was, you know, volunteering or sort of vocal in the class, as I tend to be sometimes when I think I know something. And so at the end of the class, people approached me to ask the rabbi, because it was hosted at his synagogue, could I ask the rabbi, could he continue in another semester? Could we continue the class after the session was done? So I was volunteered and I asked the rabbi and he said, no. I said, what do you mean no? People want to learn. He said, well, no, I can't because I have bar mitzvahs to prepare. I have other classes to prepare. I have, you know, I don't have time in my schedule to do it, but I could do it. I said, what do you mean I could do it? I'm not a clergyman. I don't know, you know, I don't know details about religions and so on. So there's nothing you have to know, nothing you have to learn, just plunge in and do it. And frankly, that's how it started. And that was 16 years ago. And as I said, the group has not fired me yet. So here we are. And we've all learned a lot of depth about each other's religions, the beliefs, the tenets, the do's and don'ts, the morals, the values, and so forth. But also, again, you know, what's important to everyone. We've learned each member's life story. We've gone around and discussed each person's life story and how each person came to his or her own religious realization, perhaps, because many people did not start out being religious, and many people are not religious. They're just in our group. And now we discuss topics of common interest. So, for example, one of the topics which I find really fascinating that we will be discussing in February. I think I can look up the date in a moment. I think it's February 19th. And it's a topic that was suggested to me by one of our members. Yes, February 19th. These sessions are held by Zoom, a Zoom link which I send to people starting at 6 p.m. Pacific time and 9 p.m. Eastern time. And the topic of the article that this member sent to me is, why are Christians so cruel and in the world? And I have changed it to say, why are so many religious adherents of all religions so cruel to each other, so cruel to other people. So it's not just Christians. It's Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, all major religions, with the possible exception of the Quakers, have been extremely cruel to other people and probably to their own religious adherents. So that's the topic we will be discussing in February.
I love that. And I want you, I'm trying to think of, since it's on Zoom, I'm trying to figure out the best way to let people know what that is. Is it some weird, complicated thing, or can you tell me where to go find it if I want to attend?
People would simply have to contact me. I'd like to speak to them, very briefly for about 5 minutes or so to ensure that they are a good fit for the group.
Again, sure.
It's open to everyone. And then it's a Zoom link that I personally send out to our members.
Okay, cool. So if I wanted to, or someone listening wants to attend that, because it's a fascinating topic, and I want to talk a little bit more about it in a minute. But how would somebody get a hold of you to ask permission or to have a brief discussion with you to make sure they're not going to be disruptive but productive right. in coming to the show?
To contact me by email, please. And my email is philip@auerbach-intl.com. That's Philip with one L, P-H-I-L-I-P. And then at auerbach-intl.com.
Cool. philip@auerbach-intl.com. Yeah. So if you're interested in that, go. And I think you should. So I want to talk about that topic for a minute, and I want to talk about something else, because I'm going to dig into Philip for a minute. Mm-hmm. Because it's now clear to me from the two things that you're doing. One is a business, and you're helping people expand, but the way you're describing it and doing it has a certain flavor. And the flavor of that is the same as the flavor that I'm getting with this desire to have brotherhood, fellowship, understanding, and whatever it is around religious conversation. What's going on in your heart that makes this something you want to put your time into? I mean, there's all kinds of stuff you could be doing. What's in your heart that makes this something that says, Philip, you're going to do this?
I guess it's a very simple concept that arose in childhood, and it's simply to repair the world. There are a lot of different concepts of what reality is, and I don't want to get into that necessarily, because each person or each group may have its own sense of how to define reality. But one religious outlook, I guess, is that if you believe in God, God created the world, but then God left it to people to carry on the work after that. I don't want to be disrespectful to anyone, but it's a way, God created the world and then rested, but then left it to people to handle it after that was done. Now, whether one believes that God created the world or not is not the issue, but the world is both a superb opportunity. It's gorgeous. It's wonderful. It's also ugly and tremendously chaotic and tremendously superb all at the same time. So whatever one's belief is, you can either ignore the world, which some people do, or you can participate in the world, or you can say, I can do whatever I'd like, and I can go to my church or go to my religious leader and ask for absolution of whatever sins, whatever damage I may have done to other people, and carry on. Well, personally, I don't buy that so much, but again, that's up to personal beliefs. But we're all in the world, and you can either choose to participate in it in whatever way you want. There's no one way to do it. Or you can choose to ignore it. Most people don't ignore it, but if you are in it, why not make the world a better place? And so
The reason I asked you the first question is, how are you adding good to the world? The way I say, we breathe, we add carbon dioxide. But we can choose what else we add to the world. We add animosity. Do we add negativity? Do we add complaining? Do we add harmony? Do we add service? Do we add, you know, what are we adding to the world? And I wanted you to explore that, because that was my sense. You're making a conscious choice to not only for you add good to the world by holding the thing, but by having people reflect and talk about these things to give them the opportunity to add good to the world in whatever they understand about it. And trying to get to a common understanding is never going to happen. And it doesn't matter, but we can all choose to add good to the world.
Yeah, and I should also add that this value, whether it was spoken or unspoken, was very much a value of both of my parents, my father and my mother. And my father, for all of his negative qualities, was a wonderful philanthropist and a wonderful, extremely generous, and also believed in improving the world in his own way. And so this was conveyed to me by both parents and respective families.
Fabulous. So you were infected with adding good to the world on all of your different environments. How cool.
Yes. Yeah.
So let's talk about this topic that's going to come up on the 19th. What, you know, in the name of religion, if we were to even pretend to list 1/1,000,000,000 of the atrocities and negativity that has been perpetrated in the name of some kind of religious belief, it'd take the rest of our lives. We won't do that. But when you discuss why are religious adherents markedly unkind, all the way to cruel and even vicious, what drives that? When ultimately, when we sit quietly and experience, you know, our own origins and the feelings that are inside of us, we can come to a place where we know that that's not true. And whether you do the non-duality thing or not, and you're hurting yourself, or whether it's another person, I don't care. But we don't. And I'm wondering what do you think drives that lack of awareness that is so pervasive and profound?
Well, I think the question is, why can devout adherents be so cruel to each other and to the world? Not that they are, but they have the potential to be. Look, there are some common answers that I'm sure will come up. One of them is lust for power. One of them is ego. One of them is the feeling that our religion is right, or my belief in my own denomination, my own specific belief in my religion is right. Everyone else is wrong. Everyone else is a heretic, whatever you may want to say. And, you know, I have the right to impose my religion onto other people because I am right, you are wrong. And I think that's abominable, but that's the way a lot of religions, personally, I think that's abominable, but that's the way a lot of religions behave in many ways. So some of it, again, is power. Some of it is forced conversion. Some of it is racism. You know, there are many different reasons for it. And again, there's no one reason. But you know, why are people so cruel? I think, you know, they're ultimately not focusing on the true essence, the true meaning, the true values that their religions promote, and instead they're looking at external factors.
I love that, and I would agree 100%. And another thing that seems to pop up, and I don't know that this is people of religions being cruel, is the more powerless people seem to feel in their lives, then the more, at least it seems to me, that whenever they get an opportunity to exercise control or power over somebody else, they do it in sometimes wildly nonsensical or egregious ways. And it seems like it comes from a sense of feeling a lack of control.
Yes, lack of control or entitlement. You know, I'm better, stronger, smarter, more powerful than you, and therefore I have the right to control how you think, what you do, how you behave, how you treat other people, what's right, what's wrong. My way is right, your way is wrong. That's simply the way it is. And, you know, it's, again, comes from narcissism, comes from egotism, comes from a total lack of concern about, lack of compassion and empathy about other people.
I want to go just on that pivot with that thought trailing into the next piece about the nonprofit foundation that you had in California you're going to reestablish in Philly. Because a lot of nonprofits, in fact, I would say the majority, are started with the idea of addressing some kind of injustice and unfairness, and whether it's a result of circumstance or climate or religion or whatever, but they're started by people, do-gooders, and I use that term lovingly, mm-hmm. who are trying to fix something. Like you said, we're trying to fix the world, which is what you described earlier, and that's this whole point of the show. How do you create a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy by serving with your gifts and talents, which is what you're doing and we're talking about. Tell me more about what you did and what you're doing or going to do with this lifting of, and I'll call them nonprofits, but that's just a name for lifting those or helping people find resources or elevating those, the power and success of those who have made it their mission to add good to the world in some particular corner.
Now, if I can digress for a moment, my motivation for doing this started with CNN. And at U.S. Thanksgiving, I know in Canada there's a different date for Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Around Thanksgiving in the U.S., CNN does a wonderful show each year called the Heroes Awards.
I've seen it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if it's broadcast in Canada, but mm-hmm. it's there. And I started watching this many years ago, just by accident. I had no idea it was on, and it was broadcast one year, and I was absolutely astonished because there are like 10, perhaps 10 finalists. I don't know how people vote, but apparently these nonprofits, they're all nonprofits, and they get nominated, and then somehow people vote, and they're 10 finalists. They're all invited to the studios. Each one presents, and then there must be another vote, and then there's one finalist. There are semifinalists, and then one finalist, and all the semifinalists get a certain amount of money, and the finalist gets a lot more. So that's all fantastic. And these nonprofits are both in North America and abroad, and they do outstanding work, just beyond, I can't even think. The causes were just wonderful. I mean, hunger, homelessness, veterans. I can't even think of the causes because they were just all so extraordinary. So what happened was that as I was watching this show, and I watched it over many years, and each year, of course, there are different nonprofits and different causes, and I kept thinking how wonderful it would be to start a nonprofit and to remedy some of these problems that the nonprofits are talking about. If not remedy, then at least to alleviate in some way, because mm-hmm. in many cases, I don't think they can be remedied. But to alleviate the issues that they're talking about. And I couldn't think of any one cause, because all of the causes were extremely valuable, each in its own way. Mm-hmm. And so when I was wanting to form a nonprofit, the woman whom I approached to do all the official formulations taught me the word capacity building, which I had never heard of before. Mm-hmm. And basically it means to strengthen the infrastructure of a nonprofit, the management, the marketing, the fundraising, the ability to deliver its programs internally so that it can be much more effective in accomplishing its mission. And she said that, and what she told me was that the focus on capacity building sort of cuts across everyone, cuts across all nonprofits. And internationally, these are called NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And effectively, it means the same thing. And so instead of focusing on one cause and competing, for one particular cause, because there's so many nonprofits focusing on different aspects of one cause, whether it's spaying feral cats to alleviating world hunger or whatever, or environmental issues, doesn't matter, that instead it would be beneficial to create a nonprofit that can uplift all boats simultaneously, to be the rising tide that lifts all boats simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that became what we did and what we wanted to do originally. And again, we were closed down. I shouldn't say closed down. We decided to suspend operations because of what some bureaucrat told us that we needed to do, which didn't make a lot of sense. And it took me $25,000 hiring a lawyer to reverse this bureaucrat's decision. And in doing that, I decided, all right, I'm not going to bother with California anymore, just moving the nonprofit to Pennsylvania where the laws are not as burdensome, and just wait, you know, to restart the original mission of the nonprofit in Pennsylvania under the new name of the Nonprofit Uplift Foundation, because that's ultimately what we're doing.
I love it. And I'm going to repeat a couple of things I heard you say, because I think it's so extraordinary. I have a client who helps people start nonprofits. And I think I mentioned that to you when we talked before. But I love the idea that, you know, cutting across all the capacity building, you know, the messaging, the marketing, fundraising, because those are things that every nonprofit has to do. If they have crappy messaging, they don't attract donors. And absolutely, they're not able to deliver their goods and services and do the good that the founders are dreaming about, you know, the way they're thinking about changing the world. So, and you said something in your initial thing about automatic grants and stuff, but I want to talk about programs. So I'm going to make something up and then you need to correct it. So it sounds like you create programs or education or some kind of thing that's going to teach me as a nonprofit, which I'm not, but if I was, how to fundraise. So you're going to tell me how to approach people, how to spell out a mission, get them light the fire and get the vision painted so that I get people excited about the cause to the extent that they're going to contribute and so forth. So is that an area? Did I describe that right?
Yes, that's one aspect of it. Yes. So first of all, our focus will primarily be on small and medium nonprofits, because the large, the extremely large ones were probably don't think that they need help necessarily.
You know, and so, I'm look, sure and some, you're going to be buried in small and medium because there's a zillion of those.
Exactly. And most of them are, of course.
Yeah.
And by the way, I think I have to look up this statistic, but it's something like 30 to 50% of all nonprofits fail within the first 10 years. And one of the reasons is they don't have strategic plans, and they, you know, the nonprofit founders are wonderfully altruistic. They're extraordinary human beings who have a superb cause to uplift humanity. But a nonprofit, an NGO, is a business, and they don't realize that it's a business, and they don't, the leaders don't necessarily understand the business mechanics of running their operation. So, what we intend to do is one of the programs will be a monthly LinkedIn or Facebook group where we just perhaps have a common topic and invite members to, you know, to join and to share their insights, their wisdom, their collective wisdom, so that they can, you know, I know a resource for this, or have you thought of that, whatever, just again, sharing ideas. Another will be courses in specific broad topics, which of course will be narrowed down: management, marketing, grant, fundraising, operations, board governance, and so forth. Another will be specific resources, and this is where we get into some of the, again, the particular people who can specifically assist nonprofits. So my vision is to have perhaps five private sector companies or private sector people in specific topics, such as grant writers, such as website designers, such as cause marketing, such as brand management or brand development, nonprofit formation, perhaps, you know, specific topics that nonprofits absolutely need to, again, build themselves, build their capacity. Another part of our group will be what I'm calling unique funding opportunities. Most nonprofits, 99% of them, have two ways to raise money. One is through donors and grants. Donors, individual people, and grants from perhaps government entities or corporations or so forth. And usually this is done through lunches and dinners and appeals, mail, direct mail appeals, postal appeals, whatever. And those work, but they can be very cumbersome and, you know, non-dependable, perhaps. So there are other ways to raise money that most people don't know about, such as certain kinds of auctions, certain kinds of charities where I know of an organization that will create an auction, either live or online, for nonprofits for no cost up front, but taking a small percentage of the money raised. There are people who do wonderful performances, for example, of magic shows or art shows or something like that, impersonators, unique ways for nonprofits to think about raising money that they hadn't considered before. And the other most unique element of all of this is that I want to be able to give automatic grants to our member nonprofits. Now, it may start only in North America initially, but I'd like to expand it internationally. But automatic grants. And again, I've not put together all the mechanics of how this would work, but my vision is that the organization will be a membership organization, not for a lot of money, but for approximately $650 US dollars per year, paid in monthly, an upfront fee, a membership fee, and then monthly installments. And at the end of 12 months, we will be able to reimburse the fees, the membership fees, and add to that and provide additional financial resources, additional financial support for these nonprofits to carry out their missions. And I won't go into all the ways that we plan to do this, but that is my vision of how we're going to do it. So, and this is, by the way, for no application. Applications are onerous, burdensome, a horrible process, and very often nonprofits, NGOs get a small percentage of what they ask for, or you know, perhaps they get full funding from groups that have funded them for the past 5 or 10 years, because they're, you know, they're trusted by that point. But it's a burdensome, long process. You have to do the application, you have to wait, there are funding windows and so forth. So dispense with all of that. If you're a member, if you join at the end of 12 months, we will send you a payment. We will just give you an automatic grant. That's the vision. How we do it has to be worked out, but that's what I'm considering.
This is just spectacular. We have about 3 minutes left, and I just want to tell you, I love what you're doing. Your heart and your love just like bleeds out of you in all three of these areas. And I just, delightful. It's one of the reasons I wanted you to come and share that. So now in our last couple of minutes, I want to do two things. The first thing I want to do is ask you, what didn't I ask you about that is near and dear to your heart that you would like people to know or to do or to consider because we've talked today?
Oh, I can't think of anything except, it's sort of what I like doing in addition to what I've described, but I love having private, you know, one-on-one or small group luncheons and dinners with people. Mm-hmm. I love having, you know, people who are even if they're not making an impact in the world, they are in some way. Most people are in some way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just to share what they're doing, what's important to them, get to know other people. I love reading. I love, talking to people. I love going to other groups just to meet people. I love travel. This is something also for people to consider, to think about. I've been extremely fortunate. I've traveled very extensively around the world to about 56 countries, some of them multiple times, and to most of the world, I should say. And this also enables me to see many different points of view from many different perspectives, which again, most Americans and most North Americans simply cannot do. So I feel I've got 1 foot here and 1 foot abroad. And when one travels, there are two ways to do it. One can either observe or one can absorb. And sometimes you do both. But observing is seeing the sights, you know, enjoying the food, having the beer, whatever, you know, talking to the people. But absorbing is the culture, the music, the sports, the politics, the thinking, the way of thinking, the values, the what makes people think and behave the way they do. Why do they react the way they do? Understanding their religions, understanding their different perspectives, understanding their tribes. In every culture, by the way, every country has tribes. That's a pejorative word, and I don't care because that's what they are.
No, I agree, and I love it. So we're going to need to be done here. I want to make sure. Is Philip at Auerbach-intl.com. That's the best way and the sure way to get a hold of you to find out more or to do something.
That's one way. Also, go to our website, which again is Auerbach-intl.com. There you will see a general email, which will reach me. And there is an ancient device on our website, which is listed. This ancient device is called a telephone. It's a communication device that does work. And if people wish to, they can simply use this ancient communication device to communicate, because there are a few of us who still do like to talk to each other.
I love that. Philip, thank you for sharing your heart, your soul, your smile, your joy, and your passion for connection and adding good with us today.
Thank you, Kellen. It's been a delightful pleasure and honor to be with you today.
All right. Thank you. So I want to encourage everyone that's watching this, go back and listen again. Auerbach-intl, Auerbach International, but put that hyphen in there. .com. Go see what they're up to. I've looked at it. There's all kinds of stuff. And he's an amazing guy who's committed to adding good to the world. And so are you, or you wouldn't be here. And I know that if you follow the intuitions and passions of your heart and make choices about how you add good to the world, you will create your ultimate life.
You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.